Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
It's JPGN podcast time, but we're meeting today for another round of Journal Club with Dr. Jake Mann. We're reaching you today, and I think it's appropriate to say this, from ESPGHAN's annual meeting, which is being held in Helsinki, which is, of course, the capital of Finland. And in Finland, what do you have to be on the alert for? Fish tapeworm. Thank God that the prices for sushi in Helsinki are so outrageous that none of us is going to be eating any of that stuff. On the other hand, there is herring. There is omnipresent herring. Diphyllobothrium natum, scourge of the north. Wish us all luck. Jake's choices for today, aside from the dietary ones, are from Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition by Keller et al., writing from a number of North American institutions, defining normal bowel wall thickness in children with inflammatory bowel disease in deep remission, a multicenter study on behalf of the Pediatric Committee of the International Bowel Ultrasound Group, IBUS, and I can't believe I did that all in one breath, and from Hepatology by Schwimmer et al., with investigators principally based in San Diego, California, long-term mortality and extrahepatic outcomes in 1,096 children with MASLD, a retrospective cohort study. The JPGN article complements one recently discussed here at Journal Club. That article posed the question of what additional value is sonography in assessing the extent of small bowel involvement by inflammatory bowel disease at presentation. Our conclusion was, well, it's not good enough to displace or to replace other techniques, but it does pick up some disease that enteroscopy with biopsy and magnetic resonance imaging studies miss. Particularly useful, perhaps, in patients who don't tolerate other techniques well. The work by Keller et al. Is not the other half of that diptych. That is, it does not pose the question of what additional value is sonography in assessing extent of small bowel involvement by inflammatory disease after clinically successful treatment. That work remains to be done. A necessary lead-up to that work, however, is to determine by sonography how thick the wall of the bowel is, large and small, after inflammation has receded, with comparisons between regions assessed before as involved and regions assessed before as non-involved. The present study offers standard values likely to be useful in clinical practice. Of course, aspects of study design permit quibbling, and Jake is a past master at quibbling, as I think we'll find out. But overall, I found this study truly a pleasure to read and to think through, and I strongly recommend it. Jake, what do you say about that?
Well, firstly, it's obviously a pleasure to be here and be chatting through this in person. And whilst my B12 levels remain topped up, let's try and tackle these papers.
Now you're with a high mean corpuscular volume, you're not going to be in the best state. I think you'd better just take a look at a blood smear before we proceed.
Well, we'll give it a few weeks for our tapeworms to materialize. The bowel ultrasound paper, I think, is one of these studies that isn't necessarily very sexy on the surface, but is necessary, important, and may well be quite well cited because you need normal ranges. I think that they've got a relatively substantial size cohort, nearly 100 children. It sounds like a reasonable number of values, nearly 500. They have, I suppose, moderately broad confidence intervals over their ranges, but that's all within actually a not very big physical range. You know, we're talking from 1.5 to 3.54 millimeters. So you need a high degree of accuracy even to resolve down to that level. And they, at least how they've written it, have addressed the question that they wanted to know. Is the normal range in this context, in children who previously had IBD, is their bowel ultrasound thickness smaller than that of adults? And, well, it is. As predicted, there are a couple of points that I would raise from a quibbling perspective. And the kind of go-to with all these studies is how generalizable would this be to our cohort? Is in the cohort of patients that we see on a day-to-day basis. It certainly is very representative of patients with inflammatory bowel disease. Their mean age was smack bang in the teenage years. However, they do make several comments about whether age had influenced their measurement of bowel wall thickness. And I suppose I'm a bit skeptical as to what extent they can extrapolate their data to say age was or was not a factor in influencing normal bowel wall thickness when you have a very defined, narrow range of ages included within the study.
So, please don't say more studies are required.
No. Not going to go for that cop out. I just, I think that I wouldn't go as far as saying age does definitely not influence bowel wall thickness, because I think that until you've studied...
For heaven's sake, we've seen it at the autopsy table, or at least I have. Age definitely influences bowel wall thickness.
Particularly when the authors, and one of their main conclusions, well, their primary conclusion is median bowel wall thickness is lower in children than adults. And then the next line of their abstract says, age does not influence bowel wall thickness.
Which we don't believe.
Well, the two cannot both be true. It must be smaller in some extent. But I mean, that's otherwise, it seems like a well-conducted study. The one bit that didn't make sense to me was the negative association between disease duration and bowel wall thickness. So the longer that the patient had had since their diagnosis of inflammatory bowel disease, the thinner their wall of their bowel.
Why is that a problem? The longer it's been since the diagnosis of their disease, the more treatment they've had, and the greater the opportunity for any increase in bowel wall thickness to resolve.
Yes, I suppose, assuming that they've been in sustained remission since then.
Audience at home, I have run rings around him, logically.
I suppose in my mind, the longer that someone has had since diagnosis, the more opportunity they've had for relapsing, remitting inflammation. And therefore, I would have expected it to become thicker and with potential deposition of extracellular matrix tissue. Or I guess there's many ways in which it could change.
See now, folks, this is what you get from overthinking a situation.
I guess I'm just surprised that after...
It's my gift to take a complex and possibly irresoluble problem and come up with a wrong solution.
Well, I suppose I worry that if you do enough statistical tests on these things, you come out with something that isn't necessarily a biologically meaningful answer.
Okay. Shall we declare a truce?
Truce it is.
Truce it is. All right. Then let's move along to MASLD, which occupies far more space in our heads than it's really worth, don't you think? Anyhow, grappling with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in children, or more recently, metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease, MASLD, has never been easy. A child has abnormal clinical laboratory test results that suggest hepatobiliary injury. Well, those tests were obtained for no particular reason other than vigilance, as with determinations of fitness to take part in sports, but there's something not quite right here. And then 3 months, there's still not something quite right here, and the patient is referred for specialty evaluation, or more often in the last several years, I expect, a fat child is defined prospectively as being fat, therefore being ill, and has a medicalized condition and is referred for specialty evaluation. The child goes off to the imaging study department, the report comes back, and the liver is likely fatty. Now what? The natural history of MASLD seems largely to be undefined. And so long as that is the case, actions are random. One needs a prognosis. And the more detailed the prognosis one has, the better set up one is to know what to watch out for, to understand how outcomes arise, and to consider intervention if those outcomes are undesirable. The authors write, the primary objectives of the study were to quantify the mortality rate and identify the causes of death in individuals with pediatric onset MASLD. Secondary aims were to evaluate the incidence of cirrhosis, the development of extrahepatic outcomes, including type 2 diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia, and obstructive sleep apnea. The authors followed for a mean of 8.5 years, 1,096 children aged between 2 and 18 years, who were diagnosed with MASLD between 2000 and 2017. Their findings demonstrate considerable hepatic morbidity and extrahepatic comorbidity with an increased death rate. The population that they studied, being based in San Diego, California, was 80%, quote, Hispanic, close quote, which precludes facile extrapolation of their conclusions to other ethnic groups. Some Mexican-American boys notoriously are butterballs. If in your culture food equals love, that's what happens. And the author's findings will be and perhaps should be used to warrant screening and intervention. Diet, exercise, GLP-1 receptor antagonists, and thus are worth attention. Jake, your perspective, please.
I suppose it depends how excited you get by things like this, but I found this paper very exciting. I've been looking forward to a paper like this for some time. There's been but a handful of papers on the long-term outcomes of patients, children with MASLD, and the one that is very heavily cited, nearly 1,000 citations from Feldstein et al. In Gut, was a very small cohort with retrospective analysis. Many of them had had liver biopsies, but I think that the diagnoses were even established at a time when MASLD was not a common diagnosis in children. And
would that have meant it was biased toward the more severe forms?
Almost certainly. And they included several patients with acquired hypothalamic insufficiency who then had very rapid progression of disease and did very poorly. So
it's a very different kettle of fish, tapeworm.
It one of the worst kettles of fish. And I suppose I was interested to see a replication of the study from a very well-established unit, well-characterized patients to see what the overall mortality rate is. There's also, leading up to this, been a couple of other papers from Europe, but population-based studies with identification of young adults through coded diagnoses and then tracking their mortality, which absolutely has its utility, but is also open to bias and other problems for that reason. So this, though retrospective, they also recall patients for a prospective follow-up as well. Jeff Schwimm is widely regarded as the person who's done all the fundamental studies on this topic. So I think what he reports, everyone believes. And it has broadly shown that pediatric MASLD is associated with increased mortality at a really young age.
So what are you going to do next? With your tubby little Birminghamites?
I think that it emphasizes to me that this is a condition that is worthy of treatment and management and seeing in a specialist service. Albeit it's hard to identify it at an individual patient level, who will go on to have liver complications and who will not. Some of the factors that they identified in this paper was that children who were of higher weight had higher fasting insulin, lower HDL, were more likely to die. Presumably they had worse insulin resistance. We didn't have postprandial testing of kind of a peak glucose tolerance insulin level, but I imagine that would have correlated and probably even shown greater effect than the fasting insulin. I suppose it was interesting to see that the baseline liver histology fibrosis score, for example, didn't associate with outcomes.
If you're going to go from there to not needing to do a liver biopsy, I'd warn you.
I absolutely would never suggest such a thing in present company and...
Or even outside present company?
Or outside present company.
Thank you.
Of course, of course. With that in mind, one of the comments about this paper is, as you alluded to, the generalizability. So in terms of blood tests, certainly the cohort is very similar to the patients we see in Birmingham. However, we don't do so many liver biopsies. But the benefit of it being a liver biopsy-defined cohort is we have a high degree of confidence that these are patients with MASLD and not something else. The downside is that compared to other patients who perhaps are seen in a general pediatrics clinic or an obesity clinic, this is certainly going to be a much more severe group. And it is harder to generalize these results, as you say, in an 80% self-identified Hispanic population compared to, let's say, a general pediatric obesity clinic being run in Finland with children with mildly elevated liver enzymes. It's hard to know whether we can really extrapolate this data and say, well, this is your rate of liver-related mortality, for example.
Mm. Let's talk about Dr. Schwimmer having a good reputation and being well-respected internationally. And is he a prophet then without honor in his own home territory, or might he not see a much broader base of fat children referred directly to him rather than being cared for in the community? If you've got a hero right around the corner, why wouldn't you send your kids there? Why wouldn't you have, rather than a highly selected, highly comorbid group of overweight children, why wouldn't you have a much more representative set of kids?
I'm sure that at the clinic they see a whole range of children. I think that's a fair point. I don't entirely know why, for example, they didn't also report data on children who had been seen, suspected to have MASLD, even though they didn't have a histological diagnosis. Was it possible to follow those up? That would be
an interesting leg of the study, wouldn't it, if it had been done?
Yes, though, as you say, you'd have... it would feel a bit different because then you'd have a very well-characterized cohort and then a less well-characterized cohort, and you can replicate all the same associations, but it would be an interesting component to the study.
We never get everything we want, do we?
No, not in papers and not in life.
And with that, we don't have enough time to keep continuing, huh? St. Jake, it's been fun keeping the ball back and forth going across the net, and I thank you for showing up today.
Thanks, Alex. Chat soon.